All right. Well, this week, Tiger Woods is getting back to golf now. It's been over 4 months since the story of his extramarital affairs made headlines all over the world. He'll hold a press conference later today, presumably to get the media frenzy out of the way so he can focus on golf and getting ready for the tournament. But still, he has to have a lot on his mind.
I'm excited to get back and play. I'm excited to get to see the guys again. I miss competing, but still, I still have a lot more treatment to do. And just because I'm playing doesn't mean I'm going to stop going to treatment.
Well, if Tiger Woods considers himself still in treatment, how will that added pressure affect his game? Tiger Woods has golfing pressure, of course. He's got family pressure, media pressure, public pressure, and money pressure, and about 17 kinds of pressure that I can't think of right now because I'm under pressure live on the radio, I suppose. But does Tiger Woods handle it better than I do? Now, Tiger Woods has finished 71 times on the PGA Tour. He's finished first 71 times, so the man knows how to handle pressure, but he's going to be under significant amounts of it today. So we want to talk about the neuroscience, the brain science, and the human reaction to pressure. We're joined by Jonah Lehrer. He's author of How We Decide, and Proust was a neuroscientist, and also Sion Bylock, associate professor of psychology at the University of Chicago. So, Jonah, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, how do pro athletes avoid the pressure effect? All of the glaring eyes, all of the people watching you, and still, in this case, sink the putt from 19 feet. How do they manage that?
Let's make a long story short. They do it by not thinking too much about what they're doing. There's been a lot of research in the last couple of years on what happens when people choke. And the basic lesson is that people choke when they start taking actions which are best performed on autopilot, things we've done a million times, whether it's making a putt or shooting a free throw. And when they start thinking about how exactly to perform those actions, whether it's how to hold the basketball or how to hold their putter.
So don't overthink it, is what you're saying.
Yes. So find a way to think about anything but what you're doing. So, ironically, if Tiger's thinking about one of his mistresses, that's probably a better thing to be thinking about than how to sink the putt.
Indeed. But how do they do that, okay? Because college basketball is also happening, a big game coming up in the Final Four, the national championship game. And these kids or any basketball player gets on the line. The game's a one-point spread. They know that everyone in the country's watching. The fans are going nuts, and they still sink the free throw. I know it's rote, but I just don't know how they get in that headspace.
Well, that's the difference between you and me and LeBron James and Tiger Woods.
The only difference, obviously.
I think professional athletes have learned these tricks. They learn these tricks when they're first standing on the free throw line in middle school and high school. They've learned how to think. And I think you see even in the NBA, some superstar athletes have never learned how to think, and they're the ones who, swish the air ball in the fourth quarter when the game's on the line.
Well, Sion Bylock, associate professor of psychology at University of Chicago, take me on a tour of the brain here, the things that Joan is describing, not overthinking it, getting into the part of your brain that's just rote. How does that work once we go inside the brain case there?
Well, what we show is the prefrontal cortex, that's the part of the brain that sits directly over your eyes, is really involved in conscious monitoring and control. And oftentimes when people are highly skilled at what they do, this brain area becomes less active, allowing things to run off more on autopilot. And one idea is that under stress, people are so concerned about performing at a high level. Tiger has a lot riding on his performance, and so the prefrontal cortex comes back in and tries to control parts of his performance that might normally run outside of conscious awareness. So as a result, he's more likely to make a mistake.
But then why? It makes me ask the question why we can't do both things at once. Why can't our brain say, okay, I got to make this putt perfectly, I can't mess up because everyone's watching, and still do it right? Why do they have to be isolated to make it work?
Well, I think, that might be what great, successful, optimal performance is, even when the pressure is on. But sometimes those areas that should be talking less end up talking more, possibly just because of the nerves of the situation. And as a result, performances are slowed down or messed up slightly, and a slight sort of error in a golf putt to win the Masters, for example, can lead that putt astray.
Jonah, I got to ask you, I come in contact with this all the time because I sing opera. The point is that you practice so much that you don't have to think about it anymore, right? You practice until it's habitual, and doing it right is is what you're naturally going to do. But how do you translate that into somebody's everyday life if they're at business, if they're at work and their business meeting makes them nervous or anything like that? How does somebody make that practice model part of their everyday life?
That's exactly right. I think that's the whole point of practice, is that when we're doing it, we don't have to think about it. I mean, I think there's been some interesting research with some practical takeaways, which is that instead of focusing on the details of what we're doing, the precise details of keeping our wrists straight when we're putting, or, you know, how to hold the ball when shooting a free throw, or not getting nervous when public speaking, instead, people should fixate on vague verbs and adjectives like smooth and straight. And somehow thinking about that allows us to focus on something performance-related, but without focusing on, you know, little details like holding your wrist or how to breathe when singing that might distract from our performance.
And Joan Allaire, some people are just naturals, aren't they? You know, from the political world, everybody in Washington knows the famous story, I think in 1999, of Bill Clinton's teleprompter flickering off in the middle of the State of the Union speech. But nobody knew until afterward because he just continued and delivered a speech off the top of his head. Nobody knew the difference.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that'd be my guess, too. That's certainly my hunch, that some people just are naturally better at dealing with pressure, that for whatever reason they learned at a very early age, you know, how to think when they're really worried about making a mistake.
All right, I got to ask you, Shion Bialok from University of Chicago, when have you choked? I know I'm putting you on the spot.
That's a million-dollar question. Well, I've definitely had situations where I haven't performed up to my potential, and I think a real key is practicing and trying to practice in the types of situations you might find when you're going to be under stress. So rather than just practicing a free throw when no one's watching, practicing it when there's something on the line. Say you have to give money to your buddy or run laps if you miss. But there are situations I think where all of us have failed to be at our best.
Oh,
and,
sure.
You know, even if people do come to the table maybe more predisposed to excel in those situations, there's a lot of time they've spent probably experiencing failure and figuring out what better to do the next time around.
Well, I don't mind telling you, you know, I've written probably 1,000 news articles in my career, and I won't tell you the major media outlet where I choked during a writing test, choked big time, and didn't get the job, and I'll leave it at that, but we've all been there. Shion Bialok is Associate Professor of Psychology at University of Chicago. Joan Allaire, author of How We Decide, and Proust was a neuroscientist. Thank you both.
You can find a link to Joan Allaire's article, The Superstar Effect, from Saturday's Wall Street Journal at our website, thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.